I'd like now to welcome to the program Gregory Chalette. He is an artist, activist, and author. His latest book is Dark Matter, Art and Politics in the Age of Enterprise Culture. And his work will be shown this weekend at the Santa Fe Art Institute. It's part of the 9/11 10 Years After series of events. And he will also be speaking on Tuesday, September 13th at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary.
So your work examines the relationships between art and society. And one thing that you point out is the broken promise of capitalism, and which probably a lot of people don't even really remember or know about, but that promise of freedom. You know, we were supposed to be free and have more leisure time as machines did the heavy labor of society and so on. What happened?
Well, I think you put it quite accurately that there's almost a kind of implicit agreement that, you know, we will buy into this to a system using money to exchange for goods, et cetera, et cetera. And the end goal will be increasing prosperity and less labor in sort of the worst sense of the word, you know, heavy working, et cetera. I think we've seen pretty clearly that that has all come undone for most people, particularly in the last few years, and it seems to be going into a descending spiral where they're talking now about a jobless future, where even if you have maybe a master's degree of some kind, you'll be lucky if you can get a kind of part-time job someplace, maybe even washing dishes. That may be extreme, but maybe it isn't extreme at the moment. So what happened was, I suppose, in a classical sense, there are internal contradictions that just don't let those two things work together. The ideal of freedom and freedom from scarcity, et cetera, and the ability for some people to concentrate large amounts of wealth and use those as they see fit. They just don't go together, those two different objectives.
So how does the capitalist way of working, which you have studied in a lot of depth, affect the lives and thoughts and minds of ordinary people, particularly the vast majority of us who are not exactly the winners in this game?
I think most people feel there isn't an alternative. That's perhaps the biggest problem. And it would be, you know, I would don't think anybody would want to go back and sort of hold up the old Soviet system or any of those so-called socialist countries as a model. It seems that idea of socialism has really failed. On the other hand, after the collapse of the Cold War, we don't really feel like there's an exit. We have just one system that we confront. And I think on a day-to-day basis, that is something that plays itself out so that people feel they have to choose between, let's say, presidential candidates who really don't offer any alternative per se, slightly different politics in some cases, and certainly no difference in the economic outlook. And in the end, it really is a question of the political economy. So as sort of Slavoj Žižek sort of quipped once, you know, it's the political economy, stupid. And I think this is the question people need to kind of address, is that these things are linked. The economics and the politics are not separate spheres. They are actually intimately linked. I try to do with the book is really address that question or focus on that question in relationship to the workings of artists, the way artists work and how they work, and especially over the last 30 years.
Give us some examples of that. Kind of across the board. I mean, the way that artists are working that is really oriented toward a capitalist market economy and the ways that they are resisting that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that artists, and it's not just artists, of course, lots of people are trying to find their own way to create a distance between themselves and the most brutal form of the market economy, which is playing itself out now. In such a vivid way, as we all know. But artists are particularly good at thinking in these kind of sideways or lateral moves where they make leaps that a lot of times people who have a more kind of linear way of working don't really try to go. They don't try to go there, and artists do go there, sometimes foolishly even, but they take those kind of strange chances to sometimes provide very interesting alternatives. And a lot of the most interesting work I see going on is actually where artists are linking up with people who are doing other kinds of community activism. So it's not just artists, and it's not just the activists, but they're actually working together. An example would be the farm to table movement, which is part of, really grows out of, in some ways, the slow food movement from Europe. And it focuses on local produce, growing things ideally without pesticides, having the food be produced, consumed, and very much in a kind of local sphere, so you don't have the big box stores, the big grocery chains getting involved. And even though it may not be a solution for everybody, it certainly has become an interesting solution in many locations, such as Detroit and Chicago and Philadelphia and in parts of New York. And there are artists, for example, Claire Pentecost and Brian Holmes. The latter is more of a theorist than an artist, but they work together, and they've been doing interesting work with this farm-to-table movement. Also in Baltimore, the Baltimore Development Cooperative has been doing work where they've created organic gardens and really focused on local foods. That's just one possible direction. There's other directions having to do with urban activism, et cetera.
What is the role of the artist in the farm-to-table and slow food movements?
In the cases that I gave, or examples I gave, it's artists who are working with the food movement, and in many cases their role is sometimes to simply do exactly what the activists are doing, which is to garden and produce the food and talk about the food. But they also engage as people who know how to use the visual realm or the communicative realm, maybe to produce explanatory materials that go with these gardens and with these ideas, with this idea of this kind of local circuit, and in some ways, their medium is also the ability to organize itself. It's almost as if they've taken on kind of the world of the social as a sculptural material that they are trying to channel in certain ways or assist in certain ways. To do exactly what we started talking about, which was to create alternatives, maybe modest ones, maybe very local ones, but alternatives to the sort of alienation of the global market.
Did you just say they use the social aspect as a sculptural medium? What do you mean, if I understood you correctly, what do you mean by that?
That they use, in a sense, you might say the social realm, let's say, or the idea of people working in a communal manner as almost a kind of artistic medium. So there are ways that they build organizational structure or try to invent alternative organizational structures, which is almost a kind of artistic practice at a certain level of abstraction, really.
When I think of the gifts that are given to artists, the talents that they have, I mean, I think of representation. So whether it's drawing or painting or sculpture or poetry or fiction or filmmaking or any of this stuff, you're looking at a whole big, vast world, selecting from it, and representing it in some way, and the choices of what to represent and how to represent it are central. And I guess what I'm wondering is how this set of choices involved in representation is part of the movements that you've studied.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question because I'm actually trying to suggest that maybe it isn't about representation, that a lot of the artists that we're talking about have sought to actually move in the direction of actually, you might say, manifestation, of actually sort of working in the real world, almost, as I said, as a kind of material medium, that I wouldn't say that there's no element of representation involved. I think that one could make that argument, but maybe philosophically you can make the argument. But in a way, they're trying to actually constitute something that's material and real. And the question of representing something is maybe not what they're actually sort of driving for.
One thing that I find so striking and scary and kind of awful is the total marketing of every aspect of life. There seems to be less and less non-commercial space all the time. And I wonder, so I mean, there was a moment where they started putting ads on the turnstiles in subways, and they started putting ads inside of taxi cabs, and there's advertising everywhere you go, and, you know, even prisons are privatized, water is privatized, somebody copyrighted genetics. I mean, there are genes that are copyrighted, that are owned. Okay. Is there, in your view, is there a natural breaking point? I mean, does it all fall apart at some point?
Well, I think what you described, of course, is extremely frightening. And I don't think that the realm of the arts has escaped it by any means. Maybe just to kind of keep question tight for a moment. My biggest concern is that some of these practices that we were just discussing, where artists are working with activists, etc., that some of these practices will themselves then end up becoming a kind of commercial brand. And I think it's very difficult to avoid, let's call it branding in a general sense, as you said, every object suddenly becoming part of a sales pitch in a sense. And so many things that we would have considered normally, let's say, part of the public world have become, in a sense, privatized or owned. You know, for example, as you say, the patents on certain genetic, codes even. So there's a kind of mining of everything that's not nailed down, and maybe even the things that are nailed down, by the market so that it owns all of that. Is there a tipping point? So it's a good question. I think one would like to think that there is some kind of elasticity that eventually snaps and pulls things back. This is a kind of, you might say in your mind, a kind of physics metaphor. We think that if we drop a ball, it falls. We assume if we slip, then we fall down, you know, gravity's going to knock us down. We apply these things thinking there are sort of natural limits. It's not clear that there really are natural limits to this process. And it may really require organizing clearly in opposition to it and not trying to fall back on the idea that somehow it's going to sort itself out, because I don't think it will. I think, you know, people are going to have to wake up and do something. I'll just give you one quick example. Critical Art Ensemble is a group, and they've done a lot of work around the question of privatizing the biosphere, you know, for example, genetically modified foods. They actually tried to create a kind of take-home test so you could bring your vegetables home from the market and see if they'd been genetically altered or if they were, you know, pre-genetically altered types of foods. They're really interesting, very, very engaged artists. And they try to also produce this work in such a way that it's a gift. This kind of goes back to the previous question. There is at work something of a gift economy that opposes itself to the idea of the branded market. And many of the artists and activists who I was referring to try to kind of operate in the realm of the gift, giving things without expecting anything in return. And that Critical Art Ensemble, I would recommend to listeners, maybe Google them, take a look at what they've done. One of the narratives attached to this is that one of the founders was actually investigated by the FBI. In fact, he was being prosecuted by the Justice Department for about 4 years under the George Bush Jr. administration. And finally, that case was solved, but you can look this up. And in some ways, this was probably a reaction to the group's criticism of the Iraq War, the criticism of the way the government was moving after 9/11, and also a criticism of the privatization of things like genetics, biology plants, etc., the Monsanto Corporation being one of their targets.
We're talking to Greg Shalette, artist, activist, and author, and his latest book is called Dark Matter, Art and Politics in the Age of Enterprise Culture. I think one of the things that's so difficult about the critique of capitalism is that a good portion of consumer culture actually does make our lives, people who have access to it, which is most of us here in the United States, more comfortable. And so if you took away, you know, laptops, central heating, cheap Advil, things like that, people would go absolutely bananas. And so you can't, there's a kind of hesitation to throw the whole thing out. Nobody wants to do that. But to kind of keep the good parts and get rid of the bad parts, that gets very complicated very quickly.
Let's not forget things like Ambien.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that one, but Advil is my good friend.
It helps you sleep at night. I mean, I think your point's well taken, and I don't envision a society, either from a kind of, let's say, environmental critical position in which, you know, there's no conveniences left and we're all, like, sitting around caves, which is absurd, or from a kind of anti-capitalist position where there is no such thing as any kind of exchange or production or useful devices or technological innovation. I have a feeling sometimes these are like kind of panic button responses to the idea that we need to rethink the system of the economic system we live in. It's as if, well, if we have to do that, then we have to change everything and there won't be any of the good things left. I think that's, you know, really a kind of extreme way to look at it, and not one that I think anyone would endorse.
Right, but then, what do you change? What do you keep the same, and who makes those decisions?
Well, I guess one of the questions would be: is it necessary for example, the heads of corporations, the heads of the financial sector, and I'm talking about the heads of the corporations themselves in many cases, but also the chair people that are on these organizations, et cetera, is it necessary for them to be making salaries that are astronomically greater than the people that work for them? What is it about the concentration of wealth, particularly at this moment, that needs to be directly addressed, and why is it seem to be moving in the other direction, where some of the most prominent candidates for the president are literally talking about even concentrating more wealth in a smaller sector of the economy? What about education? What are people going to do when they have lots of education that they've paid for, that they're in debt for, and what they've done is essentially have skills, or they produce skills that they can't even realize on the marketplace? Nobody's interested in them doing what they were doing. They end up doing, if they're lucky, things that maybe are in the service sector. These are the kind of questions that one has to sort of ask and begin with to address your question, which is, all right, let's talk about how wealth is distributed and who gets the benefits. I think some of the other issues would fall into place if we began to look at things in those terms.
That is very much of the kind of question that many, many political activists are asking. And so getting back to the role of the arts, what is the role of the arts, of the artist, of artist collectives in putting those questions out to ordinary people and getting those discussions going?
I think the role of the arts is going to be what, you know, artists can make of it, what they will make of it, and maybe what they're pushed to make of it. It's pretty clear that a lot of artists don't really reflect on these questions. They don't look at the questions in terms of their own practice or the world of the arts, let's call it, the market for the arts, which they're inevitably part of. This is one of the reasons that I wrote the book, was in a way to shine a light on the practice of artists and to ask some of these fundamental questions about, let's say, economic justice, actually at the level of artistic production. And that's maybe in some ways not addressing the question you asked, which is, what can artists do for, like, everybody else? But I do think that artists themselves need to first take a look at their own situation and examine carefully what is the political economy of the art world, how might that change? And by doing that, you also take a step towards raising those issues in a broader sense. In terms of your question, there's clearly a number of artists, and I've already mentioned some of these groups, Critical Art Ensemble, the Yes Men, Baltimore Development Cooperative, Center for Tactical Media. There are a number of artists who are trying to sort of put forth in a more public way these very questions through their art, sometimes doing it with a great deal of humor, like the Yes Men, but they're trying to get it beyond just the realm of the arts. And I really applaud that kind of work, although I think that there's room for all kinds of artistic activity. I do applaud those kinds of interventionist, let's say, practices. And that's one model that people could begin to sort of focus on.
Well, when you look at the difference between the model of the Yes Men and the model of somebody making art and trying to sell their art in galleries, often to the wealthiest class of people who are the heads of these corporations or who are in a much higher income bracket. But, I mean, the Yes Men, those are academics who have tenured jobs at universities. So it's just apples and oranges.
Well, actually, it's not the case. Only one of the Yes Men actually has an academic job upstate New York.
Well, one of the two.
And the other one is actually on the job market, by the way, at the moment. And they didn't begin the work they were doing as Yes Men with academic jobs or security, I can tell you that. But they're also broke, you know, and they've put enormous amounts of their own money into the projects they did and, of course, haven't really realized much in the way of personal profit from it.
Yeah, exactly. What I'm saying is they need an outside income source. So, you know, either they have an academic job or they have a job in commerce or they get funding from somebody else. But it's not a way of making, the models that you're suggesting are not a way of making a living.
No, I don't think it's a question of necessarily being able to make a living in this economy. I mean, it's not like I can say to one of my students, I teach in a city school, which is a public school here in New York, it's not like I can say to one of these young people who are often the first generation to go to college, hey, you should be just like the Yes Men and spend all your time doing interventionist art, because I know very well that that's a very, very difficult road to take for anybody. So although I present that kind of work, I certainly don't hold it up as the model for everyone. That doesn't mean one can't begin to sort of think about the way this kind of practice influences what you do, and it should. As far as sort of being sustainable, I think that's kind of the question you're getting at. It's a very difficult one right now with the economy crashed everywhere, but there's two things to keep in mind. One is that artists have always been very, very good at finding these kind of odd ways of surviving. Just as I mentioned earlier, that they kind of think in sideways terms, they're very good at creating little niches for themselves to sort of get by. And, you know, that's a plus. I think if artists began to really work together, they might look at the value that's been accumulated and accumulates in the art world on a regular basis and start to ask the same questions about, well, why is it that a few artists or a very small group actually have so much of a share of the overall value that the art world generates, because in a sense everyone participates in creating that value. And there are maybe ways to address that problem, particularly using some of the new technologies. So think, for example, of a peer-to-peer kind of art world, or P2P art world, in which the galleries and the large collectors maybe are bypassed for a different level of exchange. It's not a radically political suggestion. It's just perhaps a way for artists to sort of survive in this situation.
What do you mean by that? Like when you say the galleries and collectors are bypassed, what is the alternative model?
Okay, so let's say you set up a series of internet sites where people could access your work, and people who wanted to buy your work just went ahead and did it. I can give you an example, which would be Just Seeds, which is a site that you can actually, it's Just Seeds, JustSeeds.org, and it's a website set up by a number of artists who sell their work very inexpensively, and yet they're actually able to make enough to kind of continue with the website. So, hang on one second.
Hi, Howie. Everybody?
Mm-hmm. So that's an example of one way to, you know, kind of self-organize in relationship to, you know, the current economic situation.
Gregory Shalette is an artist, activist, and author. His latest book is Dark Matter, Art and Politics in the Age of Enterprise Culture. And once again, his work will be shown this weekend at the Santa Fe Art Institute. It's part of the 9/11 10 Years After events. And he will be speaking on Tuesday, September 13th at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. For more information, 505-424-5050. Or you can call, you can go to the website, SFAI.org. Greg, thanks so much for being with us at the Radio Cafe.
Absolutely, Mary. You're welcome.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at KSFR.org, podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at Facebook.com/Radio Cafe, and my email address is RadioCafe@KSFR.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz. Thank you.